Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Brendan Dunn, and he's an IWW member, and he's also an adjunct professor. So Brendan is here to talk about the plight of adjuncts, you know, throughout the country. So Brendan, can you give us an overview of what it's like to be an adjunct professor today?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on the show. And just to be clear, so I'm wearing a couple of hats, but I'm an organizer with SEIU Local 200 United. That's Service Employees International Union. It's a local that's part of, you know, one of the biggest unions in North America, SEIU, that's really been taking the lead in organizing adjunct faculty across the country for a number of years now, and has launched a movement called Faculty Forward. But as you mentioned, I am also a Wobbly. I'm in the IWW, and I'm also a member of NYSIT, of the Teachers Union in New York, where I teach as an adjunct professor at Mohawk Valley Community College. I teach history mostly, but also political science and other classes. I've been there for about 6 years now. But for a number of years, I've been working in higher ed in a number of different capacities. But, you know, when we talk about adjunct faculty, I think it's a kind of big, you know, dirty, dark secret of higher ed. And when we talk about the crisis of higher ed, because I'd say it's probably fair to say that the overwhelming majority of people, you know, in the broader public don't know what an adjunct professor is. And I think they have this notion that professor, you know, to be a college professor, it's a cushy job, it's great pay, great benefits, a great retirement plan. And while once upon a time that seemed to be true for the overwhelming majority of faculty, most professors in this country are adjunct faculty, or they're contingent faculty. And by that, I mean, you know, part-time, low-paid, low-wage employees, essentially. There's no job security. There's no benefits. There's no health insurance. And this is something that's changed pretty remarkably in the last, really the last 20 years, but the last 40 years more generally. Back then, you know, we're talking 1960s, 1970s, around 80% of professors in this country were tenure track, all right? And those are the full-time positions with the pay, good pay, salary, benefits, job security, the whole nine yards. I mean, the ability to research, to write books, and that's not the case for most of us. I mean, just in the last 40 years, those numbers have switched, and now it's hovering around 80% of professors in this country are those low-wage workers, essentially, with no health insurance, no job security. And the day in the life of an adjunct professor, I mean, I could just kind of speak to my own experience, but I think it's one that I think most professors would resonate with, and that it's very similar to their experience. So I started teaching, like I said, 6 years ago at Mohawk Valley Community College, and I was actually hired in 2 weeks into the semester because one of the adjunct professors found a full-time job, understandably left 2 weeks in, moved to Pennsylvania. I understand that happens, but the whole semester as a brand new teacher, I was really just flying by the seat of my pants and trying to create, you know, history courses from scratch. I was using different books, ones that the students preferred to the ones that were the textbooks that were used prior to my teaching there, you know, creating the lectures, doing all the prep, grading the papers. For a 3-credit class, I was making, I think then it was around $2,000. It may have been, it was around $2,000, just a little bit above. And we are in the process. We had just, before I started working there, the adjuncts had organized a union with NYSIT. They won a union election, and they're in the process of bargaining for their first union contract. So we didn't see the benefits of that directly, yet, and we eventually did, and it was a lifesaver for me. I mean, it meant that pay increase that I got meant not getting evicted from my apartment. It meant my, you know, meet my needs and my abilities to pay my bills and all that. But my salary, if we could call it that, for a year as a college professor, and, you know, part of it was my option, but I want to give it my all. I want to provide the best education possible for my students. So that's meeting them at times that work for them. That's being on campus when I don't necessarily have to be there. That's getting up at 5 or 6 in the morning and working until midnight or 1 in the morning, all day, every day, you know, 6 days, sometimes 7 days a week, writing, you know, writing these lesson plans, doing my own professional development and research, doing these lecture preps and these presentation preps, grading papers, you know, calling students, meeting, responding to emails and everything else that I had to do as a professor, working as, and this is essentially unpaid work, but I mean, most of this was as an advisor for a couple different student groups. And so my salary for that as a college professor that essentially was working 6 to 7 days a week for a whole year was about $12,000. $12,000 for a professor job. And, you know, I would have to hustle in the summer, you know, work as a house painter, as a laborer, you know, doing what I, whatever I had to do just to get by. And I was on, for the first few years of teaching, I was still on Medicaid and food stamps as a college professor. And I think the irony of my job as a college professor, which is really the only job I've ever worked in my life out of probably, you know, over 30 different jobs I've had. And that's a lot of temp and seasonal and low wage, you know, manual labor, agricultural, janitor, like factory work, you name it, I've done it. This is the only job I've ever worked where I actually needed a degree in higher education. And I got paid the lowest there than of any job I've ever worked. And that includes fast food. That includes janitor work. At the end of the week, I probably make between anywhere between $1.50 and tops maybe $2.50 or $3 an hour. So that's just to give you an idea of kind of my experience working as an adjunct professor. I know others, they, you know, they might work a full-time job and teach a class on the side. Many adjunct professors, they're teaching not only at one school as I did, but at multiple colleges. I mean, I know professors that, you know, they live in Albany or in Ithaca or in Rochester, and they're traveling, you know, 2 hours on the road to go to one college, an hour on the road to go to another college. They're teaching online classes. They might be teaching at 3 or 4 different institutions, and that still doesn't, that's still not enough.
So, you know, I find this so amazing because, you know, when you hear the slogan, fight for 15, you know, people, activists talked about, you know, raising the wage to a livable wage. But it seems as though adjunct professors seem to be out of the equation. You know, I haven't really heard a lot about the plight of adjunct professors. So would you say that other professions, maybe, you know, people at McDonald's or whatever, do they seem to get more recognition for their work than adjuncts do?
You know, that's a great question, and I think it's a tough one to answer because, I mean, I'll say to the Fight for 15 movement, I think it's a great concept. You know, it's one, although SEIU really, you know, put a lot of their weight behind that movement, it's the one that the IWW, I would say, are trailblazers in the sense that, you know, that union, the Wobblies, as we're also known, you know, we did that groundwork and built that foundation, as small as it was, in organizing fast food workers at places, you know, like the Starbucks Workers Union, the Jimmy John's Workers Union, working at other fast food, organizing at other fast food restaurants too. And a really, really exciting campaign right now is the Burgerville Workers Union, which is mostly in Portland, Oregon, but in some other cities and towns in the Pacific Northwest. But one thing that was great with that is that, I don't think, like, in my honest opinion, I think $15 an hour is actually, in all things considered, it's kind of a conservative ask, because when we look at how wages have been stagnant, how the cost of living through inflation and stagflation, all these changes in the economy over the last few decades, if we want to be real about things, if workers are getting paid the same exact minimum wage that they were getting paid at the height of American prosperity, which is, between 1968 and 1970, today workers would be getting, I've heard, anywhere between $23 to $26 or even $27 an hour. So that's just what workers were making back then in today's value, in today's dollars. So $15 an hour is inching a little closer to the kind of spending power and the kind of wages that workers had and what they're getting back in the late 60s. I think to answer your question, I think there's certainly been quite a bit of coverage in the media, and I think in public discourse too, about Fight for 15. It's a household kind of slogan right now. It's whether you love it or hate it, or you have different ideas on it, it's people are talking about it. It's very palpable. It's spread across the whole country. I don't think that's happened yet in the same way as it should with adjunct faculty. I also don't want to go down that slippery slope maybe some professors would and say, well, we should at least get paid what fast food workers are getting paid. Our labor is more important than that. Our labor is more valued than that. I think, we all have something to add, and I'm not a worker that values my labor above that of other workers. But I think the lesson I take away at the end of the day from the Fight for 15 movement is that, many of these fast food workers are getting paid more per hour, but that happened through like collective action, collective organization of fast food workers, over the last several years. And I think that's something adjunct faculty need to, generally speaking, live up to that and kind of take the lead of successful worker organizing.
With the fact that many, many college professors make what I would call not a living wage, and with so many students that will be graduating with debt insurmountable that will be with them for decades, what do you think the overall feeling of what's going on, or atmosphere in colleges today? Because you guys are not getting enough. The students will be, indebted. And I see it as a vicious trap where it's a trap of poverty. So what is the overall feeling of people who are in higher education today? How do they feel? I'm sure that a lot of them are not happy with what's going on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it is like a vicious predatory cycle. And even, my kind of own experience with Mohawk Valley Community College, I'm alum. I was a student there for a semester, when I transferred between two different state colleges, one in New York and one in Washington State. I went there for a semester. I haven't paid off that debt. And it's just one semester. I remember I had the foresight, at least when I was younger, I knew I would accrue debt. I had a feeling that since then I would never pay it off. I think a number of students have that same kind of feeling today, but that's in part why I chose to go to state schools and a community college. But that vicious cycle is that, it's like these, straight out of the Gilded Age in the later 1800s, these company towns where you're in perpetual debt and servitude to these institutions that they own the housing, They own the company stores. They own everything. They own you. And I feel like that's a very, very similar situation to what many people that are students and then become educators in higher ed, they're bound to that system and in a sense owned by that system. So I just remember thinking about the irony of teaching at my alma mater, teaching at my college I was a student at years ago, and not making enough money. I mean, I was to pay off my debt just to that, you know, one semester going to a community college. I mean, I was paying nothing and so was penalized for that to the tune of $3,000 a year. That was my punishment for being too poor to actually pay off these student loans. So I think it is a pretty vicious predatory cycle. And that's where I connect the dots between, you know, we talk about the crisis of higher education. It is a major crisis. And, you know, whether we're talking about the exploitation of, and not just the adjunct professors, I mean, any of the workers on these campuses, food service workers, janitors, you know, we're all feeling the crunch, we're all feeling the pinch. But also, you know, grad student workers is a whole other issue and the exploitation that they go through. I mean, athletes, student athletes, student workers, but also adjunct professors, and making that connection with the this, you know, this growing bubble, the speculative bubble of student debt. I mean, we all remember the great financial crisis of 2007, 2008 onward that was triggered by speculation in the housing market and, you know, the foreclosures and everything that came out of that. This debt bubble that's going to burst, it's not a question of if, but when, of student debt. And it's going to be even more severe than the housing debt bubble. So that's something that, you know, I'm paying a lot of attention on. I think it's really important to make those connections between different groups of workers and also students and see how we're all exploited by these institutions and all exploited and kind of conned into believing this false narrative of what the value of like a degree actually is these days, and questioning things like why does it cost so much to go to college these days? And it doesn't matter if we're talking about an Ivy League or community college or state school or a small liberal arts private school. It costs too much across the board. And, you know, I mean, I remember like my dad went to Clarkson College for a little while when he was younger in the 60s. And he has no debt from that school. He made enough working part-time as a janitor to pay for his whole tuition at one of the leading engineering schools in the country at that time. You know, I think there's many of us who are former students who are still in debt. You know, I'm about $70,000 in debt for going just to state universities and a community college. And not quite half of that, but almost half of that is just interest that's been accruing over the years because I've been too poor to pay that off. But something's got to give. And I think that something is our power to disrupt business as usual as workers, whether we're janitors, whether we're professors or grad student workers, but also as students who are being put into, you know, this debt servitude. We need to, I think, organize unions, you know, wall to wall. We need to disrupt business as usual. And as students and, you know, people that used to be students who are still in debt, I think there's a lesson we could take out of the Occupy Wall Street movement in the form of what was called strike debt and also the Rolling Jubilee. And these were movements that kind of, you know, were born out of the Occupy movement several years ago and that pushed for the abolition of student debt. And I think that's something that, you know, we should demand.
The presidential campaign seems to be gearing up where, you know, we have a number of declared candidates. And on the Democratic side, I don't hear any talk whatsoever about the student debt or poverty wages for adjunct professors. What's your feeling about how the campaign is going?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I haven't heard too much yet. I mean, that's not to say that, we won't hear anything later. I mean, I'm sure if anyone, and, I'm not a super big fan of electoral politics. I think our power as workers really is not, found in the ballot box. It's found in our collective capacity to make change through disruptive acts and through organizing, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our schools, and in our workplaces, and across our industries. But that being said, I think, I'm sure some third party candidates, I imagine, Howie Hawkins of the Green Party, if he's nominated for the Green Party, will raise that, and some of the other third party candidates. But in terms of the Democrats and Republicans, yeah, I'm sure that they will dance around that issue, or they will ignore it, or, and what we're seeing right now with Betsy DeVos and with the Trump administration, they're going to fight it. But that's nothing new. Whether there's, Republican or Democrat that's in power, or whichever party holds the majority of seats in, in the Congress and the Senate, I mean, this is a bipartisan catastrophe that was, I mean, created by both parties, and this is something that's been in the making for decades. Just a rising cost of tuition. What do the these top heavy bureaucracies that are often have close connections with the Republican and Democratic parties and with lobbyists and different corporations and the military industrial complex. I mean, they're in it, and it for the name of the game is money, and there's a profit motive involved. And the way I see both parties is, they really serve to act as committees of the rich, and that's what they're doing. And we, as students and former students, are in debt, and also as exploited workers at these universities and colleges, are seeing the brutality of that, on a day kind of day-to-day experience. So I don't really have any hope in making change through that electoral system. Like, I don't, I imagine maybe, I mean, the only thing I'm thinking, maybe Bernie Sanders, not that I have hope in his campaign, but if anyone's going to bring something up, it might be Bernie Sanders. It might be some other people. Actually, I mean, some of the Democratic candidates have talked about student debt a little bit, but I think it only goes so far with them. And there's been more of a push to for free community college, free tuition for community colleges. And that's a great start, but why end there? I mean, they have free, like, college is free in a number of countries around the world, and it's next to nothing. And even very close by to us, like in Quebec. And the reason why it's so cheap or free in these different parts of the world is not because of the benevolence of any politician or any political party, but it's through social and political and economic action, the power to disrupt social movements, unions, organizing, student unions going on strike. That's what we're going to need to do, and that's where my hope lies in to actually make that change.
You know, what I find absolutely amazing is I've read it and I've been told that Biden was the person that initiated in Congress to repeal bankruptcy protections for people with student loans. Now, when you're talking about 44 million Americans, that's a lot of people. But over the past couple of days, the media has focused on the fact that maybe he touched the woman on the shoulder or kissed her on the neck. But what about the 44 million Americans? Why aren't they out there screaming?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, whether it's the creepiness of Joe Biden and being, you know, an inappropriate older man. And like, I think I don't want to downplay that. Like, that's, I think, something people should look at. But you're also right that, yeah, where are these 40 plus million other Americans? Like, where is the outrage? You know, why isn't there any mention of this kind of systemic nationwide forms of brutality, forms of debt, and so on and so forth, forms of exploitation? You know, I think the corporate media, I mean, they sing a different tune, and that's one that's not, at the end of the day, it's really not going to question any of the fundamentals and norms that prop up a political and economic system of exploitation. They might just kind of lightly touch on the surface, but they're not really going to, you know, get to the crux of the matter and do real investigative journalism. And I think by and large, you know, the corporate media serves as a megaphone of the rich and powerful, not of the powerless and voiceless. And they're not doing at least what their job should be in any society, not just ours. So I think you're right, though. I mean, I think there needs to be more outrage. I think the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street, was a major attempt. It was a spark to start that discussion and to change the narrative. But we've also, in the last several years, have been dealing with trying to make sense of the very rapid ascendance of the far right wing into and fascists into the mainstream of, like, American politics. So I think it's one thing I really liked is someone that was involved with the Occupy movement. I mean, there's a saying in New York City when I was living there, when, you know, the movement erupted, that this is the beginning of the beginning. And not seeing Occupy as the end-all, be-all, as this kind of moment and movement we've been waiting for, and we need to put all of our eggs into that basket. I think there was one, you know, more realistic kind of thinking in that movement from a number of people that, okay, this is an awakening. So what do we do after this awakening? And I think that's something that we really need to get back to and organize around. And yeah, I think a big part of it is trying to find those new forms of disruption in organizing an organization that make more sense in the time and environment that we're in right now. And I think that would be questioning a lot of the fundamental kind of, structures of those organizations, you know, not-for-profits, mainstream unions, you know, a lot of other kind of traditional organizations on the left that we've been relying on for decades now. I think we need to reassess things and see if what we have right now, is that working? If not, why not? And what form of organization, what form of organizing, what form of disruption do we need right now that really speaks to people, that engages with them and encourages people to take collective action around student debt, around the exploitation of workers in higher ed, and around all these other issues?
So we've reached the half hour mark. So Brendan, will you come back on All Exits Closed and we can further talk about this?
Absolutely. I would love to come back. I think it's a really important conversation. It's one I'm really happy that you're engaged in and that you're pushing. And I want to continue in the discussion, and more importantly, and encourage other people, if you're listening, you know, if you're an adjunct professor or a student or a former student who's in debt, or you're somehow connected to, you know, the university system, to colleges, my task, or my ask of you, I guess, is to encourage you to, you know, if you're not happy with that exploitation that you're dealing with, or that you know people that are dealing with, there's a solution to that problem, and that's through organization and collective action. So I call on you to join us.
And one way you can join us is Like us on Facebook. I have a page, All Exits Closed. And I have a Twitter page, All Exits Closed. Follow us on Twitter. You'll be able to hear all of the podcasts. And we could talk about organizing, not only for 2020, but how we could solve this problem and get people to have a living wage and not be burdened with debt. So, Brendan, I look forward to talking with you again. Thanks for taking the time to be on All Exits Closed. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great night.
Bye.